Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the HTI-1 Proposed Rule Task Force. I'm Mike Berry with ONC, and I'd like to thank everyone for joining us today. I'd also like to thank our guest presenters for joining us today. We appreciate their participation. All of our task force meetings are open to the public, and your feedback is welcomed, which could be typed in the Zoom chat feature throughout the meeting, or could be made verbally during the public comment period that is scheduled towards the end of our meeting this morning. I'd like to begin roll call of our task force members. When I call your name, please let us know if you are here. And I'll start with our co-chairs, Stephen Lane.
Good morning and welcome, everyone.
Steve Eichner.
Good morning and welcome.
Nadal Briggs-Melanson.
Good morning.
Hans Bundek. I see Hans on, but maybe he is muted. Tim Gerges.
Present.
Anna McAllister. Aaron Meary. PK Lama Ocean Kenton.
Good morning.
Marie Sunder Rajan. Bill Sutherland.
Good morning.
And Cheryl Turney.
Good morning.
And Cheryl Turney. Hey, Cheryl. Thank you, everyone. Now, please join me in welcoming Stephen Lane and Steve Eichner for their opening remarks.
Good morning, all, and welcome to this Group 2 Task Force meeting for May 24th. We've got a really good agenda put together for you where we're going to have some great presentations on patient-requested restrictions and certification criterion and data segmentation for privacy and consent. And if we've got time, we'll spend a little bit of time looking at our worksheet. Do want to extend a special welcome to members of the public. We will have a public comment period towards the end of our meeting. You are welcome to contribute things electronically to chat. And when we get to public comment, there will be opportunities both to address comments either through the chat interface, or we can open up phones for live questions or live suggestions. Stephen, do you have anything to add?
May I do a quick sound check to see whether you can hear me now?
We've got you, Hans. I was on mute, however.
But now mine is working too. Okay.
Good. I just wanted to add my welcome to Ike's. I will be trying to monitor the chat as we go along and really looking forward to a rich discussion.
But before we get into our content, we're going to just do a quick review of our charge and the scope for the task force overall and this particular work group. So let's go to the next slide, please. Next slide. And I won't read it, but this is, again, just as a reminder, our general charge is to provide feedback to ONC through the High Tech Full Committee on the HTI-1 proposed rule. And there's a list of specific charges of specific items that ONC is looking for feedback particularly on. And those are available in the slide deck for your perusal. All information for meetings are available on the ONC website for members of the public. Next slide, please. So looking at today's meeting, we're focused on patient-requested restrictions and data privacy. So let's go through to the next slide and just highlights our focus. So I think that's all we got from a quick overview. So I'd like to shift to our next slide and welcome Elizabeth Myers, who will give us a presentation on patient-requested restriction certification criterion. Elizabeth, the floor is yours and welcome.
Beth, you seem to be on mute.
My apologies. Sorry about that. I was trying to check in on
who else was on from OMC, and I think it's just me for this presentation. So let's get started. This is a new criterion that we proposed in the proposed rule that was recently published, obviously, that you are all aware of and are working to review for us. I will say that before we dig in, that's for those of you who have been on the FACA for a while or paying attention, this is not new news for us, although this is a different way of thinking about some of the technologies that we've previously adopted and trying to think about ways we could build on them and build on the standards that are already in the program to try and advance additional parts of this very complicated space of managing consent, persisting consent, and thinking about different ways that privacy constraints can or should potentially be supported by health IT to replace current manual processes that are either burdensome or ineffective. So that's really a broad sort of intro impetus behind this, and we'll dig into the slides now. I apologize ahead of time, they are very text heavy. We put a lot of information into this very short section of a reg, and so it's going to take a little bit to get through some of these nitty-gritty details because they are what we want you to focus on. There are specific questions about variations in the use of potential standards and variations in the functionality that we are in particular interested in hearing your feedback. So if we can go to the next slide. Our normal disclaimers, you all have seen this over and over again, especially in the past few weeks, so we can move on. Okay, so this is the summary of the proposal. Again, I apologize, there's a lot of text. Hopefully you all have your reading glasses on, I know I do. And we can talk through what we've proposed within the rule itself. So there is an important cross-reference in our regulation that I'm going to highlight first, even though it's sort of in the middle of the bullets on the right-hand side, and that is the HIPAA privacy rule and the right to request a restriction on uses and disclosures. This is a really important thing that already exists within HIPAA and is foundational for the concepts that we're trying to think about health IT supports to enable. And the reason for that is we recognize that as we work together to advance the types of data that are available, there are always risks associated with that when we think about, I mean, you've had the presentation on DSI previously, and it had the same sorts of questions and considerations that as we advance technologies, we need to be thinking about how those technology advancements could have negative impact on different patient populations in different communities, especially when we think about things like what we're adopting for the US CDI version 3 and how individual community members or individual patients may identify some of those new data elements that are critical to their care as also being sensitive data. And what we've tried to do with this particular proposal is not define what we think sensitive data is or should be, but instead identifying and recognizing the concept that that may well be very fluid, especially for individuals who have faced discrimination or for whom there is historic discrimination inherent in our institutions, and that there may be considerations they have that they personally want to be able to have more control over certain restrictions, but do want the data to be able to flow for the purposes of care where and when they want it. So that's what we've really focused on. That's why you'll see that there is not a definition of what sensitive data means. We've explicitly noted that it is under what the patient may view, and we're relying on that construct in the HIPAA privacy rule, right to request a restriction, to sort of help set that parameter that this is about patients' choice and patients' rights for those types of restrictions on particular uses or disclosures. So then moving back to the left-hand side, what we've proposed from a regulatory point of view as a starting point, and you'll see that we're going to get into some alternate proposals as well, is that the primary proposal is that for any that a health IT module that fits under a certain set of interoperability data must do a functional criterion, must certify to a functional criterion that is the D14 you see up at the top, for any of the data expressed in 172.13, sorry, reg references again, that's the US CDI. So for any of the data expressed in the standard that is defined by the US CDI, and that does mean the US CDI version 3, A health IT developer must enable a user to quote unquote flag whether such data needs to be restricted from being subsequently used or disclosed, and prevent the data from being included in user disclosure based on that potential flag. We propose to modify the privacy and security framework. With those of you who are familiar with our reg structure, that's the suite of privacy and security criteria that sort of stand on their own, and then within that framework, it tells you which criterion needs to have those privacy and security pieces applied to it in order for it to be certified in the program. And so that's sort of how it works, that it layers these privacy and security framework pieces on top of existing criteria for specific purposes. So we've added that to this new privacy and security criterion to that framework. And then we've also added a different functionality, and this is a little bit different. We've done two pieces here. One is that first, you know, allowing a user to have the capability to do this particular piece of identifying where there's been a patient-requested restriction. But we've also done something with what is, you know, we all call the view download transmit or the patient portal functionality, to add a capability that there must be an internet-based method to request a restriction to be applied in that functionality as well. That's not totally out of nowhere. We've done these internet-based methods in that criterion in the past for things like requesting a correction, requesting review. So it's in that same suite, and sort of we thought it might fit in well there, but again, that's a question that we have for public comment and that we would love to hear from you all. So let's move on. We've got a lot of detail to get through. So what we've tried to set some parameters to give us a starting definition. You'll note that what I just described to you is all standards agnostic with the exception of the US CDI. And there's a reason for that. Our original consideration of this was trying to figure out what can and can't be supported by standards. And there are pieces that are supported by existing standards, either that we've already adopted or that are very similar to those we've adopted and are in other aspects. For example, the FHIR data segmentation for privacy, which I think we're going to have a presenter talking a little bit more about after I finish. But what we've tried to do is do a functional criterion to start with, because what we're trying to figure out is that piece where you're actually enabling the patient to make a request, and that's the patient portal piece in that E1 that I mentioned, but also the user to actually create the action that is associated with the quote-unquote flag, and that is not necessarily fully supported by the IGs as they exist currently, and so it's something that we're trying to figure out how would that work, and we ask a lot of questions in the rule about that. So what we have said specifically, though, is that enabling a user to flag means enabling the user of the module to indicate that a request for a restriction was made by the patient and that they intend to honor that request. And that's a two-part indication that's important to keep in mind. There is user discretion under the HIPAA security rules about honoring that particular request. So it's not an automated process where a patient makes a request and it goes through and there's no checking on that. It is intended for the user of the health IT, which in many cases will be the healthcare provider or an administrative representative at a healthcare provider. So the request made by the patient could be automated. In other words, if the patient does the internet-based method, that could be presented to the user to either approve or not. What we're really trying to get at is what we've heard from clinicians and providers, that right now they don't even have a way to indicate that a patient request has been made. And that's part of what we want to allow for, is that request might be made via another means. They might make a phone call, they might do some other, send a letter, or some other request method that they might actually ask the user to consider. And we wanted to make sure that this criterion, from a functional point of view, is also considering that. Again, there isn't necessarily a standard that accounts for that request made portion of a consent or privacy disclosure request. So the last piece is that what we're trying to do with this, given these sort of the gaps in what is existing in current IGs in terms of how that initial request is captured and then what happens next, is that we haven't proposed in the primary proposal, we haven't proposed a standard for that. So the flexibility to implement enable user to flag could be in a lot of different manners, depending on what the developer thinks is most appropriate and most effective. So from there, we can go to the next slide. And I think I need to talk a little bit faster, sorry, to try and get through all of this and still have room for some questions. So the standards agnostic approach, I've already mentioned this, but I've provided more detail here so that we could really be laying out for you what we want you to think about and look at. The first proposal, the primary proposal, is a standards agnostic approach. And the reason for that is, again, we know this is happening in a lot of different ways currently, and that developers have been thinking about a lot of different ways to try and support these types of workflows. And as mentioned, without a clear IG that actually includes these pieces of it, there isn't a lot of consensus on what is the right way to do it. And so our concern is that we don't want to, frankly, get that wrong. So we have done a standards agnostic approach that allows us to provide flexibility in implementation for developers to think about how this could be implemented. Again, such flags could leverage the existing standards like the DS4P implementation guides or some of the subsets within them that we talk about a little bit more in the alternate proposals, but our primary proposal would not be requiring the use of such standards for this particular criterion. I do want to mention that we do have two other criterion in our program right now that use those standards and do require the granular level for them to actually apply and or recognize security labels. But the concept of including that with a provider mechanism to recognize the patient restricted right, the patient right to request a restriction is where, again, there are gaps in how that actually works. And then finally, there's a gap in how the action is implemented. For example, those IGs all include instructions, but they don't actually include how you do that instruction. They say an action like not for redisclosure, or they say an action like redact, or they may say layers of actions depending on how the different pieces of the IG fall together, but it doesn't actually say what that means in the real space in terms of how that could be implemented. And I know a lot of you all and a lot of others in the health IT and healthcare community are working on all of that. So we're trying to keep this flexible so that those approaches could be part of this proposal or part of this criterion, and it could recognize that fluidity and that flexibility until we all can sort of move together towards consensus of how these actions should be addressed. Next slide. So the alternate proposals and a request for information, and this is a tool that we've used in the past in our regulations. Some of you may be familiar with when we were adopting FHIR in the first place. We weren't sure where the industry would be in terms of which version would be most appropriate and which supports would be most appropriate. So we used a similar approach where we propose one concept is what we think might work, and we propose alternates so that we can actually have a clear idea and provide some clear questions for the public to give us clear feedback on does the primary proposal make sense, or what one of these alternates be better, and how what is the interplay there, and what could work best. So we propose several alternate proposals that are aligned with standards that we have already adopted or standards that are very similar to standards we have already adopted. And the important part for some of these is that these are for the D criterion. These adopted standards and aligned alternate proposals are not for the view downline transmit capture. Again, there isn't a clear indicator of an IG that could be used for exactly that purpose, so we have left that one without doing an alternate proposal on the standard. So the alternate proposals are doing a layered set of things, and hopefully we've made it clear enough in the reg that it's easy to understand how we've done it. We set one where there's an alternate proposal where we would adopt the full scope of the DS4P IGs, and that's both of them. One is the DS4P IG that is already existing for CCDAs. The other is the DS4P IG that is existing for FHIR. They have slight variations, but both use the HTS security label vocabularies, and that's what we'd be referencing within the alternate proposal as the scope of the type of flags that would be applicable. To be clear, reminding everybody that those are the flags, and again, there is a set of instructions that goes with each flag, including the general purpose or what the restriction is, and then the prohibited action or action that is supposed to be taken with that applicable thing. So in adopting those IGs in whole and the security vocabulary, it is adopting the full suite of all of those pieces. So that's what that proposal is taking a look at. Should we look at those IGs and use them at least as the vocabulary for the tag, for the purpose, for the workflow, and for the action that's identified? Keeping in mind that that would mean that there is still a gap in that the action that's identified, there isn't an IG that actually says how that action that's identified is implemented. In other words, how is the redaction implemented? How is the do not re-aggregate, do not relink implemented? So there's some outstanding questions there, and we include them in what we're covering there as well. Then the second alternate proposal is to take those same IGs and recognizing that those IGs include a vast suite of potential security labels, potentially purposes, and potential actions that go well beyond what the HIPAA right to request a restriction actually defines and sets in scope. For instance, there are tags in there that relate to things entirely unrelated to the patient's preferred choice. For example, you could do something with a Part 2 purpose or a Part 2 consideration or a state privacy law. There are different ways that they capture those that would be different than the patient's request. So our second alternate proposal says that we would, should we ask the question, does a proposal, and then ask the question of should we use the HTS security label vocabularies but then apply constraints to them beyond those described in the IGs that would align the vocabularies for the purpose, for the requester, for the requested action, to only the use cases that align with the HIPAA right to request a restriction. And our questions and our rationale for considering that particular alternate proposal is that we recognize that to some extent, all of these things are still squishy in terms of how they get implemented. We know that a lot of people are working very, very hard to move things forward for individual use cases. But as we mentioned in the CARES Act final rule, even the use of security labels and how that gets persisted, like our focus for that rule was thinking about pediatric and opioid use cases. And yes, the full scope of the IGs is applicable, but it's a capability to use those labels, whereas this would be a not only a capability to use those labels, but to specifically act on them, and recognizing that the action that we're talking about is the HIPAA right to request a restriction, and that is the patient-directed request for sensitive data restrictions. The IGs themselves include a much broader suite, so we're trying to balance not making that full suite required for this particular purpose so that we can focus in on the patient right to request a restriction use case and see if we can help to advance that through this targeted focus for the certification criteria. I realize that sounds a little convoluted, and I hope that you'll all bear with me and take a look at the actual questions and you can sort of get an idea of why we're considering that. Because if you look at the full permutations of those IGs, it includes a lot of other use cases, and we're concerned that the requirement not just to provide a capability for labels, but to provide the capability to actually implement the action is where they would become difficult or potentially even impossible at this point in time. So we're still trying to think about how can we move forward with something that might be readiness without constraining the ability to do the particular action that we're looking at for this particular case. And I did see in the chat that there's a question of looking at FirePath. We are actually looking at both. The current proposals all include both Fire and document-based exchange, and as well as the patient portal. So we're covering our bases there to try and cover all of the current use cases where such a transaction might need to be applied in order to honor those types of requests. So then finally, our additional alternate proposal is similarly trying to consider, is this too broad, is this too big? Should we look at the US CDI and not include the full set of US CDI? Should we zero in, and again, not fully defining what sensitive data means, given that this is about patients' rights to request restriction, but thinking about where are the pieces within the US CDI that we have heard from patient advocacy communities already might be in particular related to sensitive data, related to stigmatized care, related to historic and potentially institutionalized discrimination. And so those particular items of the US CDI, we did an alternate proposal sort of zeroing in on where we think those data types of data elements fall based on the feedback that we've had from the patient communities, and saying, should we restrict this particular implementation, this functionality, to tagging and acting on tags for just a subset of the US CDI in order to try and keep this within scope and make it a little bit more feasible. Again, throughout this entire proposal, you'll see cases where we're saying, we think this is very important, but we very realistically understand that this is a major challenge and incredibly complicated, and we're trying to figure out, is there a way to move pieces of this forward together in a way that is feasible and actionable? And we very realistically want to hear your feedback on what is or is not feasible, what may or may not work, if there are additional constraints that we should consider. If we can go to the next slide. So the alternate proposals considerations, this is sort of going into a little bit deeper purpose behind why we've done these alternate proposals. As mentioned, our primary proposal is the standards agnostic approach. And again, I mentioned the reasons behind that. We think that this is happening in lots of different ways, or in some cases not at all, and there's a lot of work still trying to figure it out. So we want to try and allow that to flourish and help to further define where those gaps in the IGs could be filled with clearer consensus-based standards approaches. So that's our primary proposal, but we do think that there could be some value to leveraging what is in the IGs to help set some parameters or some guideposts. So we believe that those alternate proposals, which rely on those standards, may be preferable for developers, but we want to hear that. If that is the case, please let us know. And if it makes sense to constrain them or think about all different constraints from what we've included, we'd also like to hear that. And that transitions me to my last slide, which is, if we can go to the next slide, thank you. There is an extensive set of requests for information in this particular rule, given its length, in this particular section of the rule. You'll see in the alternate proposals themselves that there are questions on every single one. There are questions on each piece of the primary proposal asking, you know, is this the right way to do this? Is this something we even think of? How does this work? What does the burden look like? What is the potential value or benefit? What could alternative constraints look like? But we've also included a specific set of questions that relate to the alignment with other applicable laws. So our intent and our starting point for this particular piece is thinking about patient requester restrictions and the existing rights under the privacy rule to request restrictions for certain use cases and disclosures. And again, I refer you back to those sections for all of the questions that relate specifically to each of those proposals, each of the standards associated, and so forth. But we also recognize that the functionality itself might not discharge, you know, we recognize that that won't discharge the full workflow for the HIPAA privacy rule, including things like which disclosure purposes or other types of permutations that go with the privacy rule for it. So we're trying to be clear that it doesn't discharge the full action, it's just this piece of the workflow that we focused on and that we're trying to understand if we got that right and if doing this tool would be useful to try and help move some of the pieces forward in the HIPAA privacy rule that aren't currently supported by standardized health IT. However, we also recognize that there are other additional applicable laws that are potentially challenging, to say the least. As noted, we previously talked about pediatrics and opioids, and there's part two, and there's varying state laws for all different types of information. As everybody knows, that's continuing to become more and more complex. And so what we're asking in this particular section is if there are additional applicable laws that affect the exchange that we should consider when we're trying to think through what a certification criteria in health IT supports might look like. And this does include a cross-reference to the information blocking provisions that we've been talking about, where we're thinking about, is there a tool that could allow patients to have more dynamic requests in terms of, you know, when they want to see specific data or what types of information they want to have disclosed to them prior to a conversation with a clinician or post-conversation with a clinician. We recognize that this functionality, as we're proposing it, is trying to zero in on a slice of these use cases, but we are also asking questions about, is it appropriate? Should we consider other things? Are there ways that this functionality could be more broadly used if we modified how we're proposing it? So there's a lot of questions here, and I realize I just took up more time than I originally intended to get through the detail level. But hopefully this helps to provide you some context as you're considering further and thinking through what your recommendations may be for how we approach this, what we do with each piece of the puzzle from the criterion point of view, and if there are additional puzzle pieces that we should consider in a certain or specific way, we very much want to get feedback on how this could potentially work. So I will pause there and see, I'm passing back to Mike, are you managing if there are questions?
Actually,
that would be your co-chairs.
Okay. This is I can Steve Lehner managing questions. There's been a lot of active discussion in the chat. I do want to open the floor for any questions from task force members. If they would like to raise their hands, we can acknowledge folks that way as well. Jim.
Yeah, hey, listen, just totally endorse, obviously, the patient's ability to control sensitive information. My question is more about the feasibility given the current state of the data. So if you're a patient who's maybe not that sophisticated with how IT data models work, right, and how the EHR works, and let's say you view, I don't know, I picked HIV in the comment as something you want to kind of restrict people knowing about, right? Well, right now, even within USCDI, that may appear as a lab result and various different types of lab results. It might appear in a progress note in narrative. It might appear on the problem list, the med list. So I'm just curious about, patient expectation that they've actually restricted something and they really haven't. And that how feasible it is that unintended consequence may occur. That was one. And then the second one was really about the ease with which people are able to do this, obviously in support of patients being able to restrict information they want to, but for those who misuse it, and could we end up, how do we handle patients who want to reverse it? There's nothing in here about reversing something that they have flagged that they don't want to be shared. And second, the unintended consequences of a very incomplete record that may occur from overuse. So the first question is feasibility. The second is really about unintended consequences of safety of care. And did you guys consider those? Or
No, they were very good questions. And the first question on the feasibility, I will say out loud that I think that's exactly the type of thing that we're hoping to hear from all of you. We do specifically say almost exactly what you said, Jim, in the rule, that there's a challenge here. When we think about the reason we included the full scope of the USCDI is because that's what's the baseline in certification, and theoretically anything within the USCDI could be sensitive, right? Like a medication could potentially be sensitive even, for an HIV use case. So if we think about it that way, that was our concern in what the scope of this, it could be theoretically infinite, right? And I shouldn't say infinite, but very, very large and very, very complex. And that is part of why within the rule, we're trying to ask questions, is there a way that we can move this forward, even in light of the extensive complexity that, because right now we have nothing doing this type of, this particular piece, right? Like there isn't anything that is supporting a technical workflow to help make this particular process happen. And what we're trying to accomplish or thinking about ways to accomplish is, can we do something, recognizing that it doesn't solve the whole scope of the problem? And so that's exactly the type of question that we'd love to hear more of your input on, Jim, that we hear from you all, you know, what could we do if we can do something? How should we do it if we do something? And are we barking up the wrong tree? Is this not the way to go about making a functionality that could begin to chip away at this problem, recognizing that the problem is huge and extensive and only going to get more complicated? We talk about, in the proposal background, we talk about that we're talking about the USCDI, but what do we do when this starts expanding and thinking about, you know, genomics or patient-generated health data? How are we even thinking about whether those types of restrictions are going to be a privacy constraint? And that's something well beyond the scope of what HIPAA covers and well beyond the scope of what we can cover, but we talk about it because we think it's really important to set in context. Is this something that we could do a limited piece of the puzzle to try and help support a part of the workflow? Is that reasonable? Is that appropriate? And then to your second question, I think that we put a revocation in the patient portal piece. I will double check that, so don't quote me on it. If we didn't, please comment on that. Please provide us a note about that. But that is also part of the reason that we left it pretty open, because the HIPAA right to request a restriction isn't a blanket allowance. It doesn't say the patient requests it and therefore it happens. It's actually incumbent on the covered entity to make a decision based on the constraints of HIPAA, whether they think that's appropriate. So things like emergency restrictions or necessary for care are all considerations that are already exist under HIPAA. All of that is already part of what's in HIPAA. So we're actually not changing any of the existing requirements in terms of HIPAA and what HIPAA allows or doesn't allow for these restrictions.
Hans, your hand is up.
Thank you. And I want to start with that. This is an extremely important topic I completely agree with a couple of comments made, starting with Beth, that this is only growing. This is only going to get more as data is being shared, and we need to do something. So with a couple of other comments in the chat, can we focus on something incremental? As Jim is putting it, what's the feasibility? How does it work? Because as data is being shared, if we only focus on the source of the data and do some flagging, then where it's going to be shared needs to interpret that the same way, needs to act the same way, and the rules can change over time. Because today I'm uncomfortable sharing, tomorrow I'm not. And also a good point as to what's the data in. Is it in notes? Is it in a condition code? Is it in a lab test? Can it be implied? How is it transmitted? V2, FHIR, CDA, proprietary, NCPDP, et cetera, variety of different mechanisms. And we have to therefore be very careful that as we embark on this, that we really understand the expectations of what can we do initially and what does it need to grow in over time, and be cautious that if we start too open, too big, and that's what the current standards suggested as alternatives would actually fairly easily lead into, having a variety of different ways of going about it, that's actually going to set us off on the wrong foot. So having something focused that we understand the principles, that we understand not only the flagging, but also the infrastructure by which we can enable that the data, however it flows around, because data flows around substantially, we are finding that 90% plus of data is actually reshared with the same parties that originally shared it or that got it through other means. There's a lot of that going on. What if two sources come up with the same data with different flags, et cetera? So I think we have to keep not only the flags in mind or the data that we actually use to evaluate, have to be very careful that it's not just about flags, but it's very much as much as possible about the data that is already being documented naturally, what can we use there, and the infrastructure. So how can we carve that into or focus that into a good first or second step? And I would like to point back, and I'm looking forward to some of Mohammed Jafari's comments, hopefully in a moment as well, and actually indicators that ONC has done some great work in that space by funding a LEAP project. There are other activities in place. So I don't think we're starting at zero, but we're starting at a point where we have lots of different ideas, good ideas, some standards, some practice, but we're trying to find that kernel in there that we can say that's the right start and we can build from there based on that experience and get everybody involved in it. Because only having a project here or there is not going to do it. Allowing everybody to go off on their own is going to get divergent approaches. And I'm very concerned that that is going to actually set us off on the wrong foot. And as Jim Jersis is also indicating, that's going to set the wrong expectations. You think the data is protected in that way and held private, but it's flowing through other means, it's interpreted in other ways, and the data is still out there that is not intended to be there. And I think that's a big concern.
Thank you, Hans. I will say I'm glad that we record these because I think your entire comment should be submitted as a public comment on the world, please.
And Beth, this is like, I'm going to take the next couple of questions for myself.
Sure.
One, I think that we need to make sure that patient role and participation is really respected, honored, and part of the focus. So looking at a patient authorizing disclosure or requesting the information not be disclosed is important. And looking back at the question of, okay, whether the provider is going to honor the patient's request, I think it's important that the technology support both whether noting the patient's request and then as a secondary factor, whether the provider is going to be able to fulfill that request or not, with a basis for if they can't follow that request as to why not, PTO or other circumstance. Secondly, in that same space, having the ability to do it from a technological perspective as part of an IT module is one thing. Ensuring that that service is actually available in a findable way for a patient is a secondary but very important component. So if the technology is built into the system, but a patient can't find it or get to it, we haven't really fulfilled the full scope of engaging the patient in choosing that role or choosing the data share. Part three is looking at accountability, that if a patient requests that certain information not be disclosed, without accountability about what parts of their information are disclosed, the patient doesn't really have a way of seeing whether the provider has honored the patient's request and or direction. So it seems to me that before we get too far down the path, as we're looking at developing some really good technologies in the ability to share information across providers, we should also be able to figure out a way of accounting for that share or tracking that share and making information about that sharing available through patient portals or HIEs or whatever, so that the patient can actually validate that their wishes are being followed. I'm not sure there's necessarily a response there, but I think those are important factors.
Yeah, I think I was going to just respond and say I think that those are, you're raising a bunch of the questions that are exactly what we're trying to ask and think through. So just again, similarly to the response to both Jim and Hans, that exactly what you're saying is exactly what we're trying to understand and hear about. So I'm really glad that this particular group is looking at this, because I think your feedback is going to be essential to us figuring out what is the right thing to do with this particular piece. And as noted, we have a lot of permutations in that. I know we need to move on, and I'm actually really excited to hear from Mohammed on his presentation as well. But each of the points that have been made are exactly what we're trying to hear and understand. So I just really appreciate your dedication and your volunteering to be part of this task force and help us think this through. And we really look forward to seeing the report that the task force puts out on this particular piece, as well as the, I know each of you individually, your organizations may be submitting public comment. And we really look forward to trying to hear what you want us to try and do here.
And the co-chair is very much
really,
looking forward.
Truly a collaborative piece. Sorry, Stephen. Yeah.
No, thank you, Beth. I was just going to say the co-chair is also really looking forward to work group members entering their suggestions and refining their suggestions in the spreadsheet. Hans has done some of that, as has Deo and Cheryl, but we really want to get you in there. This is probably one of the most complex tasks that we have in our task force this year. So with that, let's hand it over to Dr. Mohammed Jafari to give us a little bit more of the background on the current state of the technical standards and how we might be able to select from them to accomplish what we're trying to get at here.
Thank you, Stephen. And thanks everyone for joining and having me today. We'll try to address, I was reading through the chat, and I would try to address some of the comments that I noticed in the presentation, hopefully, and there will be time, hopefully, to discuss things further afterwards as well. So I'll try to run through fast so that we have more time for discussion. Thank you. Next slide, please. So the first thing I wanted to note, I'm going to start with some broad observations and then get to some specific notes about the state of current standards, and then hopefully conclude with some recommendations. I want to recognize that there's a tight coupling between patient preferences and patient requested restrictions and data segmentation. I think a meaningful way for patients to be able to actually articulate their preferences is to have data segmentation tags available to them, and to have that language to be used in the policy language to express those rules. I think this kind of emerged in the chat as well. It would be quite onerous for the patient to have to go through item by item. You know, it would require a deep clinical knowledge to, for example, identify what medication line item, for example, would be sensitive and what would not, and what could lead to inference about certain conditions that are stigmatizing or sensitive in the eye of the patient. So in order to provide a meaningful language for the patient to articulate their preferences, we do need the sensitivity tags and the data segmentation in general. And So I also want to raise this, because I also noticed this in the chat, that I think policy should not be persisted on data, because policy changes. As it was mentioned several times, people change their mind, you know, they may express a restriction and they want to change it later. And I think this should be separated from persisting, the persistent attributes on the data. So I think patient consent, and I want to refer to the FHIR consent resource and the audit event that provides hand in hand both the ability to articulate the policy and through a consent management system, handle revocation and updates and changes to that policy would allow us to be able to enforce the policy without having to go back to the data and take a sweep at a large set of data because of a change in policy. And I anticipate that the policy that comes from the patient, those preferences, those are more likely to change than or jurisdictional or overarching policies. So I think we need to have a cohesive view of both of these components, the consent management system and data segmentation. And there is some emerging standards on profiling the consent resource in order to identify those flags. that are most common or most of use at the moment and most relevant. But I think the US CDI core, for example, could also include a profile of the consent for this purpose. I do want to also note that it is technically possible at a rudimentary level to enforce patient preferences without really standardizing or requiring any standard data segmentation, leaving all of that internal to the organization. But that would not be a method that would lead to an incremental approach to add these and more advanced, sophisticated features in the future. And also, it would not lead to an ecosystem where more sophisticated rules that could be processed by recipients and down the stream could be expressed and articulated and attached to data when data is raised. I think one of those that I want to mention is to release data only to the decision support, to clinical decision support. So if you want to capture obligations as sophisticated as that the data, like the patient is expressing to release the data, but not to the eye of the individuals, but only to the decision support system, so that decision support system can enable warnings in case of patient safety, so that a physician can actually call to break the glass. So that is a kind of sophisticated level of obligation that would require having data segmentation policy in place in order to be able to communicate these obligations in a standard and interoperable way. And I do also want to note that the fire audit event that is part of the consent management system would provide a infrastructure for accountability and also tracking what data was released based on what consent and authorized by what consent, and provide the infrastructure for that sort of accounting of disclosure that was of interest in the chat and also in the previous comments. Thanks. Next slide, please. So I included this just as a sample architecture where data segmentation and patient preferences can play hand in hand. I think in a consent management system where the patient-facing UI allows the patient to articulate the rules, the language that they use in order to say, you know, I don't want to share anything that is related to reproductive health, for example, that language should be consistent and connected with the security labeling system that actually identifies that sort of data. And that is essential in being able to enforce that. And the other thing I want to note is that if we leave the data segmentation out of the scope for interoperability and within the organization, we might be able to share, to enforce policy in a rudimentary way, just sharing or not sharing, but we won't be able to communicate anything further to the recipient in an interoperable way. So I think in order to be stepping towards an incremental approach where we can actually add the more value in the future, we need to be mindful of the fact that data segmentation is essential in having an interoperable ecosystem for communicating policy and handling instructions, basically. Next slide, please. The next point I want to raise is the importance of the labels themselves. I think because the labels are the connective tissue for expressing granular preferences and patient requested restrictions, it is important to have a consistent set of labels that are well-defined and are understood by all the parties. I think agreement on the meaning and the semantics of the labels is important in order to make sure everyone is actually going to enforce the policy in a consistent way. A minimal set of security labels that should be supported, I think, is important. We need to be mindful that what exists in the terminology is a very large data set of codes. There's a lot of codes in there that some of them are outdated, some of them may have been replaced by new code, And I think in order to at least create them, you keep the problem kind of manageable and tractable, I think it's important to identify a well-defined set of security labels that are understood by the community and can be implemented to address the current and most germane use cases. Next slide, please. I think I want to raise a particular concern and a challenge about sensitivity classes, because sensitivity classes are not policy. They're rooted in the content of a resource or any data object. It is different, for example, to say, you know, I consider this confidential, or I consider this resource, a resource that should be volatile and should not be redistributed or has to be deleted after use, versus this, there is HIV-related content in this data object. And because of that, there is a tight coupling between the semantics of sensitivity classes and the clinical content of the resource. And the underlying clinical concepts, if they are not consistent, if there is not a consistent understanding of what constitutes, for example, HIV or reproductive health, then there could be a inconsistent enforcement. Like one provider may consider something to be one category, and the other may consider that to not be part of that category, and that could provide an inconsistent enforcement in the ecosystem. And I think we need to determine whether this is an acceptable risk to take to allow innovation to build that technology for sensitivity tagging. Or do we want to be more conservative and leave sensitivity tags out of the scope for this round of regulatory update? Next slide, please. I do want to note that currently, other than the SAMHSA value set that was developed many years ago, I'm not aware of any other official implementation guide or any guidance or value set. There might be things here and there in the form of like research from academic community and otherwise, but I'm not aware of any other effort to standardize the sensitivity classes and the clinical concepts behind the sensitivity classes. Two final points. I think this was also raised by Hans, and data flows in different forms, and I think that it is important to make sure that labeling and segmentation and the enforcement of consent policies are applied consistently to all the gateways. And there is a need for a cross-paradigm framework. We don't have an individual implementation guide to kind of harmonize everything across different specifications, but there is an implementation guide, as I will mention a little bit later, for FHIR, for CDA, and for V2. But I do want to mention that there's a need for having a harmonized view of all, because these were developed separately and over different periods of time, and having a harmonized place, harmonized view to address all of these concerns. In an implementation guide that addresses all of the paradigms, I think it's a key factor. Next slide, please. I think everyone sort of agreed that we need to have incremental implementation. And I think it's important both in order to, first of all, pace ourselves, you know, create a stepwise plan where we can actually implement things and get more insight into what the next step looks like as we move forward. But it's also important to be able to certify things at different levels so that people who are looking to acquire products or, you know, buy services, they are also able to meaningfully understand what is the level of maturity for the capabilities that are implemented. And there's some emerging guidance on a maturity model. There's been white papers over the years, but there's no official implementation guide or specification on this at the moment. Next slide, please. So I tried to summarize some of the existing and emerging specifications and implementation guides. I think the HCS is sort of like the foundational standard that defined the general concepts of security classification and privacy tagging, but it doesn't include any concrete implementation guidance, any detailed implementation guidance. And I don't believe it defines the standard vocabulary. It just defines the structures and the general categories and types of data, data tags, but not the details. We have the CDA data segmentation for privacy implementation guide. It does refer to a standard vocabulary in the text. There is reference to both section and document level tagging. So it allows granular tagging beyond the scope of just the large CDA documents. It does address how to model security labels in that sort of the ecosystem. FHIR data segmentation for privacy is a more recent version of the standard. It was released just about a month ago. It does define a much more updated list and value set for codes and security labels of different categories. Again, it is referencing the terminology. The terminology includes a lot of codes. Some of these codes are referenced by inheritance, basically like a parent code have been identified as the determinant for the value set. And there are a lot of codes there that may not be either clear for the community how to implement, or even the semantics are not, or the delineation between the semantics of like code A and code B is not very clear. But all of that has been categorized and formalized in that IG. It does mention a maturity model as a roadmap item, and there's some guidance on integration with consent and just general policy integration in that IG. There's also some non-normative guidance on implementation of security labeling system, just general implementation notes in that IG. So I think amongst the standards that were mentioned, that this one is closest to be the most recent version and most updated understanding. The V2 has the version 2.9. It defines the mechanics of reporting security labels, confidentiality, and handling instructions, and also authorization policy. I'm a little bit unclear about the sensitivity labels. I was digging into this last night because I had a doubt about whether it is actually possible to record a sensitivity label in a V2 segment. But I will leave that for further investigation. But there is guidance on how to label V2 messages, basically. And there is an emerging specification that has just been published as a draft. There hasn't been balloted or mature enough yet, but the privacy concern of FHIR is coming out of IHE, and it does provide guidance on reporting and enforcing consent. It does address the integration with consent policy, and also the maturity model is it discussed to some extent. There is some levels of advanced or intermediate. I see in chat that Hans is confirming that sensitivity labels can actually indeed be recorded in a V2 segment. Next slide, please. So I think to conclude, I want to mention that a few key points. One is that to ensure that we do not leave any gateway open, and we cover all the possible ways that data can be shared, and at least the FHIR V2 and CDA are addressed if any requirement for security labeling and data segmentation is going to be enforced. I think it's very important and key to define a well-defined set of labels that are unambiguous and understood by all parties and address the use cases that are most pertinent to the community. I don't feel confident to lay out, you know, a set of labels myself, but I have a draft set in mind, and I think the further feedback needs to be incorporated from all different stakeholders to determine that. But I think that that would be in line with the alternative to basically take the current standards, but take a kind of a modified approach to what exists in the current specification. And then I finally also want to emphasize again that the recording sensitivity labels is something that is possible. There is a extensive guidance in that, and it's there's sufficient guidance on recording sensitivity labels, but there is the risk of inconsistency in determining sensitivity labels because of the lack of guidance on the common underlying clinical concept that would lead to the sensitivity labels. So that's where I want to pause, and I apologize. I think I went over time. I'll yield back to the chairs, and I would be happy to engage in the conversation.
Well, thank you so much for sharing. That was really useful and very informative. Hans.
There we go. Unmute. Can you go back to the prior slide? Because Mohan, I really appreciate the walkthrough that you have provided and the key conclusions that are there that I think we all should consider very carefully. Particularly is that the elements in here that we can start to build something if we do focus. That's the way that I'm understanding this, is that we have an opportunity to focus in some areas to align a certain key vocabulary that therefore can be consistently interpreted by everybody as it's being shared, or how to consider that. Looking at these four bullets, completely agreed is that there are elements that need to be exchanged because they're essential to be maintained with the data as is. And internally, based on how your system operates, et cetera, you may have additional flags or other ways to easily get access to the data that you need to restrict or not. But you can always go back to the source core data based on which that is being done. I think that that's extremely important, and that the guidance that we have elements in place, but making sure that it's consistently interpreted, that it's fully aligned, there is the ability to do that. But we may not only have to look at FHIR, CDA, and V2. The question is that in some areas, it's clearly that the parties already need to exchange the data. It's fine, there are no restrictions to be communicated, but have we covered everything with these three? I would say a lot, but not necessarily everything. But the question that I have is on the third bullet, and that's the difference between sensitivity labels and, if you will, confidentiality labels, if you look at the first one and that those kind of categories. And I'm curious, Mohan, from that perspective, is that some of those we have to be careful exchanging, because once they have been exchanged, the state may change. It's unclassified today, but it is confidential tomorrow. So trying to get a little bit more perspective on how do we help draw that line so that we can come to that that smaller set of flags that we do want to exchange, whereas the other kind of flags are ones that you can use, and perhaps in combination with the patient's discussion and their consent rules can be used to make it easier for a patient or for a consumer to declare what they want to change or not, or use them. I'm going a little bit on the side here, but we need to do similar things with privacy rules established by jurisdictions, because the combination needs to get in play. Can you clarify a little bit more where to draw that line on what to share and what not to share?
If I understand your comment correctly, so you're saying that confidentiality labels are in essence a policy expression, and the policy may change after the data has been shared, right?
Correct.
Right. And I think the confidentiality label on a data that is being shared is reflective of the policies from the source's perspective at the moment that it was shared. So if a patient designates something to be restricted, or a jurisdictional policy actually leads to a, for example, HIV-related data to be restricted, at the moment that that is being shared, that is the expression of the source to say that I consider this confidential. And if that changes in future, I think that is a reflection of the changes in policy, and it may not necessarily apply to the recipient jurisdiction. I think there is a there's some legal contention there whether the policies of the source would prevail or the recipients. So if the jurisdiction that is receiving the data is a different jurisdiction than the one that is sharing the data, which one of the rules and which one of the policies should prevail? And I think these the labels give us the tool to communicate those things, but the policy can still be applied by the general access control system on either side of that exchange. But I want to concur with you that there is an inherent difference between policy tags like confidentiality and obligations and refrains versus sensitivity labels that are inherently related to the content and the clinical content of a resource. I think a sensitivity label may change as a result of maybe the change of the science of medicine, for example. You know, that is the kind of radical change that would lead to us having to relabel sensitivity labels. But confidentiality labels are functions of policy, and the policy can change.
Thank you. Now that helps. And I think is that sensitivity labels, as you indicate, they change, but hopefully very, very slowly based on what's happening. And you probably have controls and ability to rederive them as needed based on new information that you've got, that everybody can apply consistently, because that's how we can define them in a much more rule independent fashion. But the confidentiality labels and otherwise that are really policy tags, they can change. And I think if the comment that I think we have to then look at as we progress is that it is at the time that the source classified it that way. And if we can recognize that, then we have opportunities to resolve that, where later it may change based on privacy or patient rule changes, and can manage it accordingly so that it's not going to yield conflicts and misinterpretations later. And I think those types of things on how to look at them in combination with how to apply the guidance are the areas where such implementation guidance profiling is still essential to best understand how do we collectively share it. If we only provide the set of standards that are out there, then everybody has the opportunity to interpret it slightly different or substantially different. That is going to set us off on the wrong foot. So I think these are key elements to understand what is part of our first step and what can we grow in over time to make sure that that can scale to the large variety of data that we need to manage.
Thanks. And I do want to note on that note that the FHIR-DSWP IG defines a set of extensions to actually convey the policy that was behind assigning a label or any related artifacts like a policy document or a consent resource. So that would help communicating that, you know, I'm considering this restricted or confidential based on this code that refers to a, for example, 42 CFR part 2. So we can reference the justification for assigning the labels and also the identity of the labelers using those extensions. And that would help parsing that out from the recipient's perspective.
Thank you.
All right, great discussion. Looking for other hands up. There we go, Cheryl, thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity to comment on this. Just a couple things. I know I brought some of these up yesterday, but you know, restricting data, I don't know how the certified health IT do it, but based on the way payers do it with sensitive services, it's quite complicated. And if we have to restrict data based on, you know, certain state obligations, based on some data that minors may have the right to restrict, et cetera, all of those things at least for us, end up having to be done based on identifying CPT codes or some sort of coding system to earmark data that falls into those categories, which makes it very complicated. I don't know enough about the tags that are being referenced within FHIR as to how those are or can be utilized when they're data that we're acquiring and then we're assimilating into our systems. So I think that's something where at a minimum, again, we need patient education. They need to understand when they have restrictions, what that exactly means, that they're only able to apply that restriction to the physician that they're commenting on based on what everybody is saying in the comments, that flow down is not something that would normally occur as a result of data restrictions. I know for us, when we, a payer looks at data restriction, we look at any method that the patient has authorized to get that data. Sometimes there's a protective order. Sometimes it's only impacting certain people or certain types of data. But normally it has to be categorized into something that we can electronically organize and restrict. And so I don't know that we have enough language or clarity here, how that would really occur in a certified health IT system. So it does give me pause. And I also do feel as though we need to say something about the flow down and the potential dangers that come with that, especially with all of the variances now between states and their positions on certain services that cannot be performed in some states but can in others. I just think there's a lot of opportunity here for risk that somehow we need to bring to the surface.
We have Hans' hand back up.
Yeah, question for Mohammed, whether you can share any thoughts on another aspect of infrastructure. On the one hand, we have the need to understand the data as it's being shared, what it means, how it can be interpreted on, and that rules can be applied to it consistently, a combination of sensitivity labels and confidentiality labels, if you will, to provide that. But one of the challenges as well, and particularly looking at it from a patient perspective, is that I'm seeing multiple providers, data may be shared beyond that, and my rules change. And therefore, how do I quote unquote chase down that I changed my rule in one place? How does it get recognized elsewhere? On the one hand, you can say, I'm gonna go and go to all the other places that I happen to know where the data likely is and I need to change my rules there. On the other hand, if I don't have an easy way to manage that across all the places where the data actually might be and now need to be informed about the new rules, how do I do that? So I'm wondering what some of your thoughts are, that on the one hand, we need these standards. We need to have that available as data is being shared. But how do we keep track of the changes in the rules?
I think that sort of, you know, gets directly in the heart of the problem with interoperable consent and being able to basically express consent in a way that's computable and is also understandable in an interoperable way by different providers, so that you don't have to go and change the rules at every single provider. You know, to be able to have consent utilities, to be able to have central places where a patient can choose to express their rules and that can be applied to different providers in from one place. And I think having the consent resource used in a standardized way, and some of the work that was done in the LEAP project and some of the work that's being done in profiling the consent resource, I think those are the steps to make sure that the outcome of the rules is is recorded in a way that is standardized. So, and it's not dependent to the source of where the rules or how the rules were authored. So different consent management systems can help patients articulate the rules and lead to consent resources that are standardized and are computably understandable by different providers so that the rules can be mutually understood when they're expressed across the space by different providers.
All right. Well, it is 10 minutes before the hour, and we are ready to go to public comment. Very active.
All right. Thank you, Stephen. Yes, it is. Thank you. As Stephen noted, we're going to open up our meeting for verbal public comments. If you're on Zoom and would like to make a comment, please use the hand raise function located on the Zoom toolbar at the bottom of your screen. If you are on the phone only, press star 9 to raise your hand, and once called upon, press star 6 to mute and unmute your line. So let's pause just for a moment to see if any members of the public raise their hand. Not seeing any hands raised, so I'll turn it back to our co-chairs.
Mike, you want to take us home?
Oh, I think we have a couple more minutes that I think we can use for any subsequent discussion before we close out. I did want to give Hans a plus one on the idea of looking at the data flow and flow downs, which again gets made a little more complicated further if the patient does not have access to information about to whom their data was disclosed. I don't think it's within the scope of the rule per se, but it may be that the task force wants to include as part of summary content or perhaps a recommendation outside that providing continuous patient education about consent is an important idea, especially looking at where patient consent is not necessarily required for sharing information for things like PTO and what payment treatment and operations and exactly what kinds of transactions are authorized in that space. So that, again, that's just kind of helping do a level set between providers, patients, and technology vendors. Are there any other questions or comments in the last couple of minutes regarding data segmentation or the other material we've discussed today? Devin?
Yeah, thank you very much. My apologies. I messed up and did not accept originally my invite to be a panelist. That was user error on my part. You know, one thing that does occur to me, the state law, the state consent laws are very complicated. As I tried to chime in on the chat and feel like a use case that requires a lot more, a more complete understanding of the scope of those laws to determine what kinds of technologies could be built in to help providers comply with them. But the HIPAA right to request a restriction, as HHS pointed out, I think it was Elizabeth, and then also maybe even the part two data, because that is subject to federal law, does have some flow down obligations and is, you know, currently in the process of being revised by HHS pursuant to some specific authorization from Congress, that might be a use case that allows us to kind of build in some capabilities for providers to leverage technology to help them comply with those obligations. And the right to restrict, to request a restriction in particular is somewhat appealing because I believe that you really could let a patient know, we're going to honor this restriction, but you need to understand that we may not necessarily be able to capture all of the inferential data, that it's not going to be applicable downstream. It's just going to be about what we can control with respect to your disclosures of data. You get to have that kind of conversation as part of the granting of that restriction because it is, except in the case, and I think Cheryl was alluding to this, in circumstances where the patient is paying out of pocket and requests that the disclosure not be made to their health plan, you know, it is completely voluntary on the part of entities to decide whether or not they want to grant them, but there may be an increasing desire to grant them in the context of, you know, very sensitive healthcare that now is, you know, subject to, I don't have a better way to frame it, being weaponized against the patient or their medical provider in some jurisdictions. Thank you.
Thank you for that. I do want to encourage task force members to spend some time with the worksheets. We're getting to a point where we need to begin to really focus on the development of language that is in the form of a recommendation for the HITECH to submit to ONC. There's been some great discussion and great comments in the worksheets, but we need to, again, kind of focus and begin to transform it into things like HITECH recommends that the language be changed or this consideration be made or things in that space. So please do spend some time in the next week working on that space, and that will be a major focus for our work next week. I do want to thank our presenters. They did a fantastic job. I want to thank members of the public for attending, and again, thanking once again task force members for their time and energy and contributions to a really interesting and useful discussion. Stephen, do you have anything to add?
Well, you know, we do have still 4 minutes. I hate to squander it, given how much is going on here. Cheryl, Theo, Hans, Jim, and I have all put recommendations into the spreadsheet. I wonder, Ike, if you want to sort of walk through these. Cheryl, maybe is there something here that you said or that came up today that would translate into a specific recommendation? I don't know if we lost Cheryl.
I'm not lost. Sorry, I just couldn't get off mute. Yeah, I'll go in, Stephen, and try to put something in the form of a recommendation regarding the patient restrictions and authorizations, because I do think we need something in there, and I'll work something up today.
Wonderful, wonderful. Hans, you have a couple of recommendations in there, and you've had a lot of insight in the chat. I trust you'll also have a chance to go in and update that.
Certainly will.
Wonderful. I took a stab before today's meeting at trying to get very specific in recommendations, suggesting some specific inclusions and limitations. So would be very interested in other work group members' responses to those very specific recommendations, or perhaps Hans or others, if you want to incorporate something similar, feel free to redline mine if you want to make specific changes. And Jim, I think you've raised some really important points today about feasibility and what we can reasonably accomplish in a single turning of this wheel. Do you want to comment on that? You know, what do you see personally as the sweet spot? You know, because of course we need to give very specific recommendations back to ONC, not sort of general observations. So do you have a sense of how we can do that? Yeah, Jim, you're on mute. Jim might have been pulled away, but again, hopefully we'll all have that chance. Good question, Hans. So group one and group two are really supposed to address different issues. Group two, the specific recommendations that were entered, and group one, more sort of what else should ONC be doing in this domain in future rulemaking. At least that was my impression. So I think we should, you know, try to separate our comments in that way, unless ONC has a better suggestion.
Okay.
Great. And Mark, thank you for your comment. Assuring individuals understand what is occurring is certainly critical. All right. Well, Ike, you want to send us off?
Sure. I think now we really are at the top of the hour, and it's time to close us out. Again, thank you again for all parties' participation and contributions. Have a great week.
Thank you.